Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and guys, I'm so excited to review the latest film in the John Wick franchise, Wicked. I'm super psyched about this. That's what we're talking about today, right, guys?
Yes.
Joining me today is Devinder Hardwar.
I'm so happy John Chu is very close to making Step Up to the Yellow Brick Road.
And Jeff Cannata.
In honor of this week's movie, I'm only going to tell you half of what I think. Also, surprise, this episode's a musical. Because we're gonna make a pod yoo-hoo cast.
No, okay.
Pod you cast?
I don't know.
Those are vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast we're going to be reviewing Wicked Part One. Wicked Part One. You know, actually, that brings up a good point, which is. All the trailers, the posters, the advertisements, like everything has called this movie Wicked. Then you sit down in the theater and the movie starts playing and then it says the title screen, Wicked Part One.
No, it's even better than that, Dave. It says Wicked. And then it goes part one. It shows up second.
One.
It's like,
if you were to verbalize it, how it sounded, how part one sounded, it would be part one. And you know, like a little bit.
And then
part
one. Nelson stands up and goes,
So should we put should we put Wicked Part One in the title of the episode or not? What do you guys think?
Do you think next year's movie is called Wicked Part Two?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be called Wicked.
So are these listed as Wicked and Wicked
it's just
Part
Wicked
Two?
And Wicked Part
I mean,
two.
That's kind of what sequels do sometimes,
yeah,
you know?
That's fine.
I think it might actually be Wicked colon something else. Like Wicked colon some other subtitle, I guess.
Do subtitles ever help? I don't think so.
Or it might be called, you know, Elphaba's Journey, a Wicked Adventure, right?
Like, Wicked 2. Wicked 2.
Based on the novel
Journey,
by Sapphire.
Colon, a Wicked, anyway, okay. Fine. We'll just call this one Wicked for now, and then we'll deal with the part two later. But
That's what the entire marketing department said.
Yeah, absolutely.
The posters, IMDb, everything. Yeah.
I'll just say I'm not very happy about it, and I'll leave it at that. Anyway, hope everyone had a happy Thanksgiving. Do you guys have a good Thanksgiving? What was a highlight food for your Thanksgiving, guys? Anything? I will tell you, my mom made pork belly sandwiches for every person in the family, individually wrapped.
Wow.
I don't know if you guys have had a pork belly sandwich from a Taiwanese or Chinese restaurant before, but she's able to make it exactly, if not better, than at the restaurant.
Perfect.
And it was awesome. And obviously, we didn't plan for it. She didn't tell us she was going to do it. You know, she just comes over and brings stuff.
I seem to remember you complaining, Dave, that your mom just makes too much food. Too much food.
Yeah. She goes rogue, you know?
Yeah.
She just does her own thing. Anyway,
but it's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
I like how the sandwich is just the added thing of an entire dinner. You also have a sandwich.
That's correct. Yeah. She brought a main course of ribeye. And then, by the way, here, have a pork belly sandwich as well.
Love it. You know?
That's great.
My kind of dinner.
Yeah.
She's the Ethan Hunt of a Thanksgiving dinner. It's just always going rogue. Can't tell her what to do.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yes. You guys, any culinary highlights from your Thanksgiving?
My wife made a roast pork, a Puerto Rican style roast pork, and that's always delicious. Pork, amazing. Pork. It's the way to go.
Pork. I don't remember if we talked about Thanksgiving on the After Dark or the main show. I think it was the After Dark, right?
After Dark, yeah.
Yeah. So After Dark listeners, get ready for the surprising M. Night twist. Everything I described about my Thanksgiving turned out not to be the case.
Oh.
What?
Yeah, my mother-in-law came into town, and she is so awesome. We were like, we had reservations for this restaurant. We were going to be easy mode. We're just going to go to the restaurant. She goes, or I could just make an entire Thanksgiving dinner myself. And I went, but that's the opposite of what we thought was going to happen. That's the we wanted you to not have to do anything. And so, but she cooked an incredible full Thanksgiving dinner, stuffing, turkey, gravy, mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, all by herself. I mean, my wife helped, but she like made it happen for the five of us. It was incredible. Lovely. It was delicious. She's amazing.
Lovely.
Yeah.
That's your Wicked Part One surprise.
Yeah.
You know, you came in for Thanksgiving delivery or Thanksgiving restaurant surprise. You got a home cooked meal.
It was pretty special. It was delicious. And the best part, I got leftovers.
Nice.
Love leftovers.
Well, we hope everyone had a lovely Thanksgiving holiday. And why don't we talk about what we're going to talk about today? We got some what we've been watching for you. We got some weekly plugs. And, of course, our review of Wicked. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. And support this podcast at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We're also posting all of our reviews at youtube.com/@thefilmcastpod. And we're on Instagram @thefilmcastpod. Check us out there as well. All right. Let's get to what I've been watching. This week, my understanding is this holiday season, this Thanksgiving box office, was one of the biggest Thanksgivings ever in history. And that is largely due to two films, which seemingly appeal to similar audiences, but are both doing incredibly well. That's, of course, Moana 2. Which made over $220 million, and Wicked, which was in its second weekend and made over $118 million over the five-day holiday. Those are astonishing numbers. Jeff Cannata, we're going to talk about Wicked later on this podcast, but you had a chance to check out Moana 2 in theaters. Do you think it's worthy of having received the $220 million at the box office?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. Worthy? I will tell you this. I took my entire family.
Would you have personally paid $220 million for this movie?
No, I would not. I took my entire family to see Moana 2. My kids absolutely love Moana, as most kids in America do, I would say.
I saw an article at the Wall Street Journal saying it's one of the most successful streaming movies of all time. It's been streamed over 1 billion hours, Moana Part 1.
That's just in my house.
Yeah, that checks out.
Yeah. My kids regularly sing the songs. My daughter absolutely loves singing Moana. She loves, you know, we have, my car has a karaoke feature in it. And it has a whole Disney section. And so in the car, it'll put the lyrics up, you know, on the screen. And we do constantly do all the songs from Moana. How Far I'll Go. And I see what's happening here. You know, the rock song. It's Dwayne Johnson's
song. Yeah, no, I know the song. It sounded more like a kind of a... Frank Sinatra you were doing there.
Well, that's how he starts it. He goes, oh, I see what's happening, meow. That's how he starts the song. If you've not heard the song, that's how he starts it.
I've heard it.
He doesn't say here. He says, meow.
Nailed
anyway, big, huge fans of Moana in this household. So my daughter got wind of the fact that Moana 2 was happening, and she's been talking about it for months. And the fact that Daddy got to bring us to a screening early. Well, it was just the greatest thing ever. I was the best dad ever. So on that metric, this movie is worth $220 million at the box office.
Oh, that's nice.
On that metric, my kids loved Moana 2. Came out, so jazzed, had a great time, got all the popcorn and the candy. We sat all in a row, all the four of us at this early screening. They let us bring our whole family to this screening. It was so great. Such a delight, such a wonderful family moment. Only the second movie my six-year-old daughter has ever seen in the theater. And she sat there the whole time, followed, I will add later on in the show, by the third movie she ever saw in the theater, which is Wicked. We'll talk about that later. They loved it. So it did the job, right? It did the job. Now, over on two seats down, old daddy sitting there, not as impressed.
But you put on your film critic cap. Yeah.
Not exactly. Not as impressed with the Moana 2. So it's a conflicting thing because it does the job, but it is the songs are not bangers. These are not bangers. And you feel the loss of Lin-Manuel Miranda, who I think, as I mentioned, we sing the songs in our household constantly. And they're great. I mean, up and down the list of Moana songs, it's fantastic. I mean, it rivals Frozen in our house for most listened to, most sung along with, most memorized by my children. And I love them. I love those songs. They're great. The song there's like one song in Moana 2 that I think is pretty good, but most of them are utterly forgettable. You'll be shocked to learn, fellas, that Moana starts the movie on her island dreaming about what's out there.
But Jeff, if I saw Moana 1 and remember it correctly, mm-hmm. wasn't she already setting out in search of what's out there?
Well, in the first one, she's singing and dreaming about how far she might go.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, she's wondering what's beyond the horizon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess that's different.
It's not.
It's not different at all.
It's not.
No.
It literally starts with the same beats. I'm like, she's like, ooh, should I leave my home island and go so far? I might not be able to come back. I'm like, this is exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. And okay, we're a sequel. Yeah. We're, you know, that's what sequels do sometimes. It's unfortunate that we're not treading new ground. Here we get a whole new cast of supporting characters that she leaves the island with for some reason. Because her boat is bigger this time, she needs a crew for some reason. And it's a bunch of knuckleheads that she gets from the island, none of whom make much of an impression through the course of the movie, in my opinion. They all, I think, are sort of underrepresented in the movie. It's a bummer. We're kind of just waiting around for her to meet up with Maui again. And it's fun. You know, it's fun. Like, I think Dwayne Johnson's performance in these two movies is great. He has so much swagger and fun bravado with that character. That's all back. The one song, well, there's the one song that I like is from a new character who is this incredible, awesome new character that they encounter. And the movie does absolutely nothing with her. It's this character that can like transform into a bat. She's awesome. And she's set up in this really cool way. She has a killer song. And then the movie just completely doesn't do anything with her. So, you know, this movie is kind of all over the place. It's big and flashy. The animation is still gorgeous. I think on that level, it's still gorgeous. But man, it doesn't seem to have an identity. It is all over the place. It kind of retreads things and the new stuff it brings up. It doesn't do much with. It really feels like a very flat sequel that my children adored. So I doubt they'll be singing the songs from this one. I just don't think that they'll catch like the first movie's songs did. But if you're going to, you know, what's the job of this movie? Entertain your children, right? It does that. It did that for mine. They had a great time. My son liked it. My daughter liked it. There's lots of big action. It's beautiful to look at. There's some really cool visuals, particularly toward the end. But ultimately, like it is just throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall and hoping some stuff sticks. And for me, not much did.
Well, that is Moana 2. It is available right now in theaters, and it gets the job done. But Jeff was not a huge fan. All right. I'll talk about something that I watched. And also, it sounds like all three of us watched this week. And that is the Netflix original series, A Man on the Inside. This is a new series from Mike Schur, I believe, right? Who helped to create shows like the U.S. version of The Office and Parks and Recreation.
And The Good Place. That was all him.
Good Place.
And The Good Place.
That's why you see so many Good Place actors in it, probably. Mm-hmm.
It's based off of a documentary that came out in 2020 called The Mole Agent. Now, it is it just borrows the premise of that documentary. It's not actually like an adaptation of that documentary in any real way. And the premise is of The Mole Agent and of A Man on the Inside is basically there's an older gentleman, in this case played by Ted Danson, who infiltrates an old person's home. Or a nursing home or an assisted living facility, whatever you want to call it, and needs to solve a crime. And so the show, The Man on the Inside, or A Man on the Inside is what it's called on Netflix, chronicles his adventures as he tries to figure out who stole a necklace. That's the crime he's trying to solve. And also maybe has some fascinating experiences and makes some friends along the way.
Well, I think the key point that you're leaving out with that description is that it's not his idea to infiltrate.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
He's a neophyte. He's not a private investigator. He's never done anything like this before.
Yes.
He's
been
retired
by a private investigator. Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
He's a retired teacher, a college professor,
Who
is just completely doing this as a lark. And for me, that's the entire fun of the show. Mm-hmm. How much joy Ted Danson brings to it and just seeing the lead character just sort of be giddy and goofy throughout this quote-unquote spy adventure.
I think this is a really nice show. It's very sweet, and it deals with people in a stage of life that we typically don't see on screen, even though they are becoming an increasingly significant portion of America's population. And it kind of tackles some of these big questions about how you find meaning and purpose later on in life, how you deal with the death and passing of loved ones. And it does so with a lot of tenderness, I think. So I was a big fan of the show. By the way, a big year for movies that had kind of people in later stages in life come out. Mm-hmm. Thelma, another similar film that dealt with these issues as well. That one was more of an action film. This one's obviously more of a sitcom. Anyway, I like The Man on the Inside. A Man on the Inside. Devendra Hardwar, any thoughts on this show?
Yeah, I love it a lot. I mean, I think it's really thoughtful in a way that The Good Place was, and that's kind of what I love about Mike Schur and the way he's been developing shows lately. Like The Good Place, essentially, what if we made like a TV show about moral philosophy and the decisions people make and what we owe to each other? And this one is taking a similar thing. Like, what if we really explore like what we owe to the elder folks in our societies and how we care for them and how they all relate to each other too? I think it's really sweet. Like, this is another knockout show for Ted Danson. I love him in funny, goofy mode. I've loved him since basically since Bored to Death, where I think he kind of cemented his older persona as still being a fun, wacky guy. I kind of just love everything about the show. It makes you think, makes you cry, makes you think about like what's happening with your own family members. My own, you know, my grandmother was in a similar, not as nice as an assisted living facility as this one, but she was in a place that I did not really like very much. And I saw like how little care goes into these places and how bad it could be. And that's a thing that worries me a lot about older folks in our societies, about what my parents will go through, what I go through. And this show presents a really like nice ideal of, you know, what that could be and the sort of community you could find. So I don't know, maybe it'll help people think a little more about the older folks in their lives and how they exist. Love the show.
Jeff Cannata, any thoughts on A Man on the Inside?
Totally agree. I love the show. I'm a big Ted Danson fan. I love his podcast that he does, Where Everybody Knows Your Name, with sometimes with Woody Harrelson. It's funny that, you know, I grew up watching Cheers around the TV with my family, mm-hmm. and, you know, loved him then. It's funny that that character that was so iconic, Sam Malone, is pretty much 180 degrees different than who who Ted Danson is in real life. You know, this sort of overconfident, alpha male, cocky, bravado, womanizing guy. Couldn't be farther from how he describes himself in real life. And I think this character is much closer to him. And it's fun to see him later in life be able to play characters that are as sensitive and sweet and sort of self-effacing as he really is in his life. And what he brings to the part is so genuine and just lovely, and how it just, he's just so happy to be here all the time. You know, he's just, I can't believe I'm doing this. It's just, it's a joy. And it's a tone that you don't see often in sitcoms, which this ostensibly is, especially, you know, in the last 20 years. You don't see sitcoms have become so ironic and disconnected and kind of mean, you know, the humor, and that can be very fun. I love a lot of shows like that, but it's lovely to see one that is just sweet and leads with its heart. And I think it's special in that way as well. I want to call out one specific scene in the second episode of this show that has nothing to do with Ted Danson, but his daughter is also a character. And we briefly, not enough in my opinion in the run of the show, but I wish we saw her family more, because there's a scene in episode two with her three knucklehead sons that are all sort of between, you know, sort of tween to high school age. And it is so funny. There's a scene where the son's like, I don't want to have that for dinner. And she's like, well, then make your own dinner. And he's like, okay, I'm going to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And he walks over to the refrigerator and he just stares at the refrigerator. And he's like, where's the peanut butter? And she's like, it's in the fridge. Where's the jelly? It's in the fridge. And my son has done that exact thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny to me. That scene just, I was like, I absolutely adore this show, not just for all of the wonderful, you know, sort of elderly stuff, which is great as well. But it just like well written across the board and insightful and just sweet and wonderful. This show is a real surprise for me, and I hope it gets another season.
It's A Man on the Inside. It's available right now on Netflix. We all enjoyed the movie. Check it out. Or the show, I should say. Yeah. Check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this. Well, I got to say, folks, in my opinion, the release calendar this year has been designed by a psychotic person.
It's wild.
I'm very frustrated at the release calendar, because essentially what it boils down to is there's approximately 15 good movies coming out in December, and they're all coming out in basically the second half of December.
Yeah, like 2 weeks.
So we are unable to talk about them all, unable to give them all main reviews. People are seeing them all at different times. Like some of these movies are limited release. And so all that's just a way to say that we're
all that
seeing
is a way to say that we're gonna talk about Kraven the Hunter.
We're focusing on what matters.
That's true.
Folks.
A, that's true.
Yeah.
But B, you know, like I think the challenge is to the availability, Jeff. Like a lot of these movies are like really good, and they're released in like 8 theaters or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, should we review that? Like it doesn't really. Anyway, so
something.
One of my photos fell off my wall. Anyway, it heard my anger. One of my photos that I had hanging on the wall fell off. Anyway,
it's out.
All that to say, you're going to hear us talking about movies throughout December that you may or may not easily be able to see, but you will eventually be able to see all these movies.
They're coming soon. Like, you'll be able to see them within a month or two. Yeah.
This next movie we're going to talk about is one such film, Devendra Hardwar Hit It.
Yeah, I saw Nickel Boys, the new film by Ramel Ross. This is an adaptation of the Colson Whitehead novel. It's about two boys at a reform school in Florida. I believe it's like the 50s or 60s, like at a time where this is pre-civil rights. You know, this is a time where schools can do horrible things to young kids of color. And
we should say the Colson Whitehead novel, which is won a Pulitzer Prize, is based off of a real life institution.
It's a real thing
in reality, right? It's not the real institution in the book, but it's like based off of a real one in real life.
Yeah, I mean, so the real story is that these schools existed, which quote unquote reform schools for kids, which brutalized young black and brown children and killed them. And this all was kind of unearthed over time. This movie focuses on one boy who kind of gets thrown into one of these schools unfairly, absolutely unfairly, but it's beautiful. Like, just the style of it. I did not know going into this movie that this is essentially, it is a first person narrative film, and the camera is always through the eyes of a person. So it's very much a peep show situation. It's a show we've talked about before, but I think done more elegantly than Peep Show was. Like, the cinematography, the framework, the framing of the camera is always on point, even though you're ostensibly looking through somebody's eyes. I think this is a beautifully told story that covers something that a lot of films have, and I feel like people may start to get, I don't know, a little tired of stories about how black people in America are brutalized. But I also think this is a very different one. And a really important one, too, because, yes, this is relating to a story that actually happened, and people are living with the memories of these institutions and how they affected their lives and how the people in charge, like, basically were able to do horrible things to people with impunity, without any punishment, basically. And I don't know. I love this movie. I think it's really sweet. It is told really well, and I love the style of it. Ramel Ross is a documentary filmmaker, and you can kind of see that in the way he shoots this movie. It doesn't feel like a traditional narrative film.
He made a film called Hale County this evening, which is apparently incredible. I blind bought that movie and have not watched it yet, but
that's like a non-fiction film.
Right,
too.
Right.
It's very much documentary style. Yeah. But I love his style. I love his camera work, and I love the story he's telling too. Like, it really does humanize what these kids went through and how horrible it was, and the societal pressures that kind of created all of this. So I love this movie. It's devastating, and it's something I won't be able to forget for a long time.
I also had a chance to watch this movie at Devinder's recommendation, and I agree. I think it's an extraordinary film. It is so ambitious in what it attempts, which is to tell this story in a first person perspective. I would not think that would actually work.
Yep.
90 to 95%+ of the shots in this movie are from first person perspective. And it just creates, it's the ultimate subjective experience in watching a film. So very powerful stuff, really unique style, and a style that actually serves the thematic, the themes that this movie is trying to go for. So strongly recommend Nickel Boys. It'll be out in limited release on December 13th. It's something Devinder Hardwar and I have been watching this week. Jeff Cannata, something else you've been watching this week?
I had a chance to check out the new film Night Bitch, starring Amy Adams. Mm-hmm. This is from writer-director Mariel Heller, who did that Tom Hanks' Mr. Rogers movie.
Yeah, she also did Can You Ever Forgive Me, which I enjoyed.
Yeah,
Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Night Bitch is
great title.
Great title. Interesting movie. I note that the IMDb does not reveal the real premise of this movie.
It just says in the trailer. That's how people talk about it. Yeah.
I want to talk about this movie a little bit, and then I'm going to talk about the premise. If you don't want to know the premise, I mean, you can sort of suss it out just from the title. But I will say right up front, I think Night Bitch should be required viewing for anyone thinking about having children.
Mm.
Required viewing. It is about a stay-at-home mom and her struggles with that new role in her life. That what she has given up, what she has... how hard it is to be a mom and how hard it is to try to do everything and still nourish part of your identity, your selfhood, your soul amidst a offspring who really doesn't give one little shit about you.
Little terrors, yeah.
Little terrors. I will reiterate, if you're thinking about having kids, watch Night Bitch.
And Tully. Honestly, and Tully. Yeah.
I thought this movie was awesome. I watched it with my wife, who is the subject matter of this movie. I mean, she does not stay at home. She also has a career. But mm-hmm. My wife did not think this movie was special. She thought this movie was obvious. She mm-hmm. thought it was like, well, yeah, that's just what it is. I don't. But I'm like, most people don't know that, honey. You've lived it. We've lived. I mean, I don't mean to glom onto this because it very much is about the woman's unique experience of this, particularly. I mean, there's a lot of body horror stuff in this movie, and particularly the sort of physiological change that a woman's body goes through post children. So I certainly can't relate to that from a you know, first person perspective, but so much of this movie I have lived. So much of this movie. I mean, it is unvarnished truth on screen. It is not trying. I mean, Amy Adams, to her credit, allows herself to look very unglamorous in this movie. There are moments where, you know, just a scene where she's sort of at a mommy group with the kids, and just one kid is just screaming the whole time, and no one even references it. Just the kid is just screaming the whole time, and people are just trying to go about their day. Just that, like the chaos of that is just constant for a parent, is like, you don't see it on screen. You don't see the toll that it takes, the debilitating nature of being a parent, and specifically a parent of very young children, right? She's got a sort of 2-year-old in this movie. I think this movie was awesome. It's harrowing. It's true. But it also is got elements of the fantastical. So if you don't want to know sort of how that goes, because the IMDb is like, it takes a surreal turn, which it does. So I'm going to reveal what that surreal turn is. As Devendra says, it's in the trailer. It's also in the title. This is, I would not be surprised if this is actually the inspiration of this movie, though it may not be. This movie is, you know, I grew up with a movie called Teen Wolf that was all about taking mm-hmm. the metaphor of, you know, a young
person. Your transforming body, right?
Yes. A young person moving into a different phase of life and all of the weird physiological changes that happen when you are, you know, go through puberty, manifesting into turning into an actual werewolf, right? That was the metaphor made explicit. This movie does the same thing. This is Teen Wolf, but it's perimenopausal wolf. And I think that's brilliant. Mm-hmm, and it's disturbing the way it goes down, but I think it makes a really interesting point in making the metaphor explicit, right? Like using a fantastical element to put a finer point on the metaphor. It did not work at all for my wife, who mm-hmm. experiences this and has experienced this.
And reviews for this thing have been pretty mixed, which is why I'm fascinated by it.
It's really interesting. I just thought this movie was awesome. And she did not dislike it. She just thought it was kind of stating the obvious, and wished that it had added up to more insight, something more profound. I don't think it sticks the landing for the end, but I do think the movie is worth watching, and again, required viewing for anybody getting into this situation in life, because I don't think this stuff is talked about enough. I don't think how hard it is. People are like, oh, it's hard. Oh, yeah, I know. It's going to be hard. It's going to be... No, you don't know. And I think seeing it dramatized in this way, in this sort of raw and very very messy and unglamorous way, it's not played for laughs. It's not played, although sometimes it's funny. It's not, you know, sometimes you'll see that in a comedy or a sitcom where it's like, oh, how hard it is. This movie is like, no, look, don't turn away. Look at what it does to your life. And I really appreciated that about Night Bitch.
Well, that's Night Bitch. It's going to be out in theaters this weekend, is my understanding. And Jeff Cannato is a big fan.
Yeah. A title so controversial, NPR can't say it out loud. Just wild.
Yeah. I'm curious.
That's weird. You say that word often, but
yeah. Who's you in that division?
People. It is a thing on broadcast TV.
Devendra says the B word all the time. I don't know if you guys know this.
You know.
Well, also, the context in which it's being used here is the sort of clinical, like, definition context.
Yes. Yep.
Anyway.
Feels like a mistake, though, Jeff, doesn't it? Anyway. Okay. That's from The Simpsons. It's from the dictionary, Mom. Feels like a mistake. Okay. I'll just mention really quickly, I finished watching The Franchise, which is streaming right now on Max, the one to watch for HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this show is awesome.
Great.
We already talked about it. We already talked about a little bit what we were watching when it first debuted.
Gotta watch this. Oh, man.
Every episode is so tightly constructed. It's like a tightly constructed play, every single episode. The script is just so strong. Every episode, for those who don't know, The Franchise deals with the making of an MCU-style movie. But it's a fake movie, and it's like harshly satirical about superhero films and the making of them. The movie, by the way, I'll just say, is called Tecto Eye of the Storm. It's about a guy who can move tectonic plates using his special glove. So that's the premise of the movie. And that itself is hilarious. Like, just every time I hear the word tecto, I smile a little bit because it's just such a funny concept for a superhero film.
But it's also the feeling you have when you describe any modern superhero. It's like, yeah. So this guy made a suit of armor, you know, and now he's a big deal. Now he's a superhero, okay?
Right. This guy with this big hammer, you know, like,
none
of it makes any sense. And it's kind of fun to see how that would play out in an alternate universe. I think this show is just so vicious about how these movies get made. And it's wildly entertaining. The one downside of the show, The Franchise, is it's hard to get attached to too many of the characters because many of them are caricatures, right? Like, the only one who really, I think, is kind of like a normal sort of audience surrogate is the main character played by Hamish Patel, who is great in the show. Like, this is one of my favorite things that I've ever seen him in. But anyway, all that's just to say, I love this show. I watched this entire show with my wife over the Thanksgiving break, and we both thought it was wonderful.
Glad it stuck the landing, because I was worried about that at the beginning. So yeah,
I thought the ending was awesome, personally. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought the way season one ended was amazing. I don't think I don't think the show is very popular. It's shows about Hollywood tend not to do that well, or movies about Hollywood tend not to do that well. However, it greatly appeals to me. And so I love it. And also like, probably you guys would like it. And also the people who listen to this podcast would probably like it. So if you've been following all these like Marvel developments and you know about like this will give you a glimpse of how the sausage is made. And it's horrifying. It's horrifying. But it's also about how, despite all that, sometimes like these people are laboring under basically impossible conditions, but sometimes it is possible to make something wonderful and transcendent despite all that. And that's why we say at the end of each review, at the end of the day, it is impressive that so-and-so made a movie.
It may be trash, but there's heart and soul in the trash sometimes, you know.
This show, The Franchise, could be subtitled, at the end of the day, it's impressive that the MCU made a movie. So anyway, strongly recommend The Franchise. It's something else I've been watching. Devendra Hardwar, what have you been watching this week?
Yeah, real quick, I want to mention, I have seen Robert Eggers' Nosferatu, and I freaking love it. This is ostensibly a remake, sort of like a reimagining of the silent film, but it does like, you know, follow pretty much the entire plot. So you kind of know where the story is going, but I just love Robert Eggers. I love that he exists and he can make these like really stylish, genre films that are devoted to doing what they're doing. There's no watering down his style. You look at a movie like The Lighthouse, you could like even The Witch. Like
it is amazing this guy keeps convincing people to give him money to make movies.
To make because really like esoteric genre movies.
His movies are not like huge hits, but they're all excellent, in my opinion. I think or excellent the North, in some way.
Yeah, The Northman was probably his most like wide appealing film because it's a revenge story. But even that like had its weird elements.
Definitely not wide appealing. I don't think that movie. Yeah,
I mean, I honestly think this movie Nosferatu.
Yes,
is his most kind of accessible mainstream movie in my opinion. Because it has a very like clear horror movie template, right? So
it does.
Anyway.
It does. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so I love it, but it is a slow film. Like he is a very deliberate filmmaker. And this is a movie that oozes in style. Every camera angle, like the framing of everything just feels perfect. And it's brutal. Like it's bleak in a way, but also romantically bleak and beautifully bleak at times. And, you know, you kind of know what you're getting into with the story for Nosferatu. But I think he treats it just so with care. And it's done so well that I couldn't help but love this experience. And I hope he gets to make more movies like this. I hope that people keep giving him money to make weird, well-made genre films. Merry Christmas to everybody who sees this in theaters on Christmas. It's like
yeah, we're going to do a full review of Nosferatu. That is the plan. We're going to do a full review of Nosferatu right after our Kraven the Hunter review. Not a joke. So yeah, look forward to that in a few weeks. That review should come out on Christmas Day. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more of what we've been watching right after this.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something else you've been reviewing this week. Watch it this
Well,
week.
Man, I really want to watch the franchise. Man, I just so many movies right now to catch up on before end of the year to make our lists. One of which is a movie I think Devendra mentioned way back in the summer.
I believe I mentioned it when it premiered, when it world premiered at Sundance last year, but that was like a year ago. So like
that was a year ago. I talked about it around Sundance too, but you were there, Dave. You were there for it.
Yeah, either way,
I literally was at the world premiere of this movie. Yeah,
you said hello to Joan Chen. Yeah,
yes.
This is a movie called Didi, or is that how you pronounce it? I don't know. Nobody ever says
right.
it in the movie.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a coming of age film about a 14-year-old Taiwanese boy in Northern California in Fremont. The kind of the area I grew up in, not exactly, but close enough. People say hella. So, you know, it's my turf. And I just thought this movie was lovely. So charming. I can understand why both of you really loved it. I loved it too. I think the performances, almost everybody in this movie, with only two exceptions, is an actual like 14-year-old kid or, you know, young person. It's hard to make a bunch of young kids have great performances out of a bunch of young kids.
Yeah.
It's just hard. And across the board, the performances in this film are phenomenal. And the movie really rises and falls based on those. You have to believe that this is happening. And there's just these lovely, slow moments, lingering moments on, you know, these young kids, these young actors who I assume haven't done much acting in their lives before this. And Sean Wang, who's the writer director, really, really gets just lovely performances out of all his cast. And I suspect this is a very autobiographical movie. I know the main character is called Wang Wang in it, and his last name is Wang. So I assume a lot of autobiographical stuff. It's sort of about, you know, first loves or first sort of sexual awakening in a 14-year-old kid and that weird time of life when you're sort of between those places. And it's also about skateboarding and sort of making videos. And it's just a lovely, lovely movie. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it, I just thought it was so, sweet and honest. And, you know, it's kind of dirty in the way 14-year-old boys' minds are, and crass and kind of awkward. And it just, it hits all those notes in a very authentic way. And of course, it also speaks to, you know, a immigrant experience in a lovely way as well. I just thought this movie was great. Dee Dee is what it's called. And I'm glad I got to see it before the end of the year.
That's awesome, Jeff. I'm so glad you like this one. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when I saw Dee Dee at Sundance, it was like, oh, wow. Like, I relate to so many parts of this. Not all, but like Asian American or Taiwanese American boy trying to become a content creator.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, this is, I don't know how big the audience is for this movie, but I'm one of them. And I was curious about like how it would translate to people who didn't grow up as
you know, it's the old adage, yeah. Specificity is universal, right?
Yes.
It's
mm-hmm. Find the universal and the specific, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I related to this very much, you know, obviously not my specific culture, but I certainly related to that kid, and not even my time period, right? Because I was already, you know, living in Los Angeles out of college when this movie takes place. But I love how this movie sort of places things in the, like this kid at 14 is the first generation that's really coming of age in the internet era. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
like the like MySpace of it all,
right.
And the AOL Instant Messenger that's all over this movie, and the like that early internet life where, you know, we're just starting to download videos. It's pre-YouTube, it's pre, you know, it's pre-internet being pervasive, but the young kids are all over the internet. And the parents don't know about it yet, aren't really hip to it.
Right.
Your mom isn't on Facebook yet because there's no such thing as Facebook yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's a really cool time period that I haven't really seen.
Yeah, depicted. We mostly get like pre-internet stuff completely, and we or post-internet, everyone has a smartphone.
Right,
but we rarely get this like in between time of like when many of us here and listening to this podcast grew up. Like,
yeah.
I think it's just like less. I think people find it less cinematically interesting, but mm-hmm. this movie shows that there is some potential for that. And
totally.
It's just a really specific mm-hmm. feeling, like
setting
an away message on your AIM messenger.
Yes.
Right. Like
that sound that's constantly in this movie of getting
kids
an AIM.
Today will never understand what
they'll
it
never
was
like
understand. To set an away message on AOL Instant Messenger. You know,
it's a very, I want to put, it's like post broadband, right? Like there's early internet, which is 80s, or even before that, which is like BBS stuff, but
dial-up
this is
BBS,
so for me early in it was broadband or was dial-up, but the broadband era before social media got big, that's a very specific time that this movie gets right.
And like there's a moment in this movie where he like checks to see who's in somebody's top mm-hmm. 8 on MySpace, you know. It's like it just nails all of that, and it feels very authentic to the writer-director's lived experience.
I think it's actually a valuable document of those times, because otherwise we're going to forget about it. Like we have basically no record of it.
It made me wonder, how did they get
culturally
the software footage of some of that stuff too? Like, how do you get back? How do you get that version of AIM, or how do you make the MySpace look like that again?
Probably they got a bunch of screenshots and like figured out a way
locked
to recreate it.
Anyway,
that's the most impressive part of the movie. But also Joan Chen was awesome.
Joan Chen's awesome.
I mean, I think everybody is really lovely in this movie, and it's you know, you've seen a coming of age movie many times, and this is sort of in that template, but it has its own real unique corner to carve out, and I just think this movie should not be overlooked.
Did I tell the Joan Chen story on the podcast?
Yeah, like, you did.
I met Joan Chen.
You could say it again though.
Jeff, you don't even remember that story, right? You don't even remember.
I remember you telling it, but I don't remember the specifics.
Oh, well, just that I went to the Dee Dee after party and I couldn't get in because it was so full.
Yeah.
And I started walking away from the party and I saw Joan Chen walking towards me. And obviously Joan Chen, you know, legendary actor.
This is the only time in your life where
this
you
is the only time in my life I'm
Joan
ever
going
to meet Joan Chen. And I go up to her and I'm like, I just wanted to let you know I'm a big fan and you're great in the movie. That's literally all I wanted to say. And literally the moment that I started speaking to her. Like, I stopped her and started speaking to her. She like caught something in her throat. Aww. And had to like cough really hard. And so you could tell she was like, she like kind of turned away and started coughing. And you could tell she was like suppressing her cough to be like, oh, you know, I'll say hi nicely to this person. Anyway, yeah. I probably made Joan Chen's night slightly harder that evening. And
yeah, well, don't kill Joan Chen.
Dave has that effect on people. You know, most people are allergic to you, Dave.
The movie is DD. It is available right now on video on demand. Jeff, did you see a screener or was it streaming somewhere?
I saw a screener. Yeah. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. I'm getting, you know, we are all getting, yes, we're all getting screeners right now. Screens, I'm trying to work through all these interesting movies, specifically ones that you guys have spoken about that I wanted to make sure I saw before.
It's nice, Jeff. I appreciate that. That's nice. All right, Devendra, bring us home with your last, what we've been watching.
Yeah. Also going off recommendations from you guys, I caught up with Conclave, which is on streaming now. You can rent it or buy it for a very high amount. It's at the like $20 to rent, you know?
Can I rant about this for a second, Devendra?
Yes. Okay. Please.
I study the prices of video on demand stuff. Uh-huh. And it used
for
to
a
be,
living. Yeah. Yeah.
It used to be that the movie would come out on video on demand. It would be $15 tops.
Sure. Right? Sure.
And then after like 3 weeks, it would be $10. Like that would be every major release would be $15 and then $10. That is no longer the case. Now,
well, you know what broke it? Black Widow.
Yeah, right, right. The difference is like the movies come out much sooner now on video on demand, like literally 3 to 4 weeks. And then they cost like $25 to buy, $20 to rent now. Mm-hmm. And that is significantly higher. And then the thing is, they do not drop in price at the same rate as they did before. So like,
well,
before,
they just show up like, on the free services.
It'll be magically on Peacock eventually.
Eventually. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. That's what happens. It's like, they eventually show up on a streaming service. But anyway, it's just, it's like, oh, I want to buy Zoe Kravitz's Blink Twice. You know, it's $20 still after like 4 months. So anyway, we get video on demand movies sooner. We give up, but now we got to pay an extra $10. Is it a fair trade? I don't know. Like, I don't know what people prefer, but like,
we're talking about how the theatrical model is falling apart. Like, it's all falling apart. So it's like, I'll pay that extra $10. You know, if I really want to own something, like, how much would it cost for you to go to a movie theater to pay a normal ticket price, which is above $15 these days? You get a snack or something, you're at $30.
So it's just for years. Like, literally, most of this podcast runtime. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why it was like six, seven weeks after the movie comes out, $15. Then a few more weeks, $10. Now that model has basically gone away.
It's a whole new era because the weirdos who want to rent or buy things, who will actually pay for things, will pay that little extra money so they can kind of get that. It's also what we're seeing with the sort of the weirdo tax. Those vinegar syndrome 4K Blu-rays and stuff of like classic movies, those things are $60, $70. You know, like I remember when a premium Blu-ray used to cost like $30 to $40, like $40 tops or something. So everything's getting more expensive, but if you want it, like it is. I've bought a couple of those and I don't feel bad about it.
Seinfeld, the complete series on 4K, $220, guys. What do you think? Is it worth owning on 4K for $220?
Well, there's no other way to see Seinfeld, right?
Is that the weird where they chop the top and bottom off?
No, I think they're all the. It is in the correct aspect ratio.
Well, there you go. That's what you're paying for.
Okay, sorry, Devendra. I completely derailed you.
It's okay.
The movie's Conclave.
I mean, listen,
it is available right now on video on demand. You can buy it.
If you want to rent or buy Conclave, that whole thought process is going through your head. Like $20 to rent this movie,
100%.
$25 to buy it.
Right.
I love this movie. I think it's fantastic. It's a really well-constructed thriller, mystery film. Edward Berger, I think, is just like doing this stuff masterfully. We also talked about he did All Quiet on the Western Front. He also did that Apple Vision Pro thing that we talked about, the submarine thing. And just... I think he's like a very patient director who is very good at constructing really interesting scenes of like of mystery. Like, he's very good at building intrigue among characters. I love the way this is set in an environment that I normally don't care about, you know, the sort of intrigue, the palace intrigue of the Vatican. But then I've watched shows like The Young Pope, which really handles it really well. And this is very much of that vein. I love the sort of ritual you see here. This is a movie about, you know, the Pope dies, got to find a new Pope. We got to have a conclave. We got to have a vote for this. And I love the politics of it all, the drama of it all. Ralph Fiennes is fantastic here. Like, this is just pretty solid, solid movie. Good time. John Lithgow also has a really, really great role here. So I love how claustrophobic it is, too, because this is an entire process where these guys just have to, like, be in a room and vote repeatedly. And for security measures, they also have to block out the light. So it's just like a dark room, like a dark dungeon, you know, well, it's a church, but it's a dark room where all this has to happen.
Yeah. Being trapped with the same guys with artificial light.
With no windows.
To repeat my opinions over and over again.
That just seems, and then you vote. Then you vote once in a while.
That seems like
good.
A horrifying fate for anyone.
Yeah.
Let alone people on a podcast.
Do you guys have windows? I don't have windows. I'm in a basement room with no windows.
Mine's all. Yeah. I have a window, but yes, it's never been opened.
All my light is blocked out right now. This is all artificial light I'm experiencing.
Anyway, Conclave, real good. I'm sure it'll be on the streaming service too. I believe this one will likely be on Peacock because of the distributor. So it's fantastic. If you like Ralph Fiennes, if you like a good, well-constructed drama / thriller, this feels like a movie for grown-ups that we don't typically see very often, with a title that is kind of inscrutable to most people. But this movie just kind of, you know, is not afraid to be a little inscrutable, and I kind of love that.
All right. It's Conclave. Check it out on video on demand. That's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching this week. Let's do a few weekly plugs. Weekly Plugs, a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. This week, I want to throw a shout out to my free newsletter, Decoding Everything, at decodingeverything.com. Tansy Gardam is a podcast host of a show called Going Rogue. It's an excellent podcast chronicling the history of troubled movie productions. And she wrote a piece for decodingeverything.com called Why We're Stuck in an Endless Hell of Live Action Remakes, in which she discusses the history of live action remakes at these big studios and why they keep making more of them. Check it out at decodingeverything.com. Huge fan of Tansy Gardam. So grateful to be able to work with her on pieces like this one. Give it a subscribe free at decodingeverything.com. Devinder Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, I was off last week, so I wasn't up to too much at Engadget, but I do want people to check out the latest episode of the Engadget podcast. My colleagues, Sherlyn Lowe and Jessica Condit, talked about the changing landscape of social media and their thoughts on like what a future PlayStation Portable could be like, another portable console. And, I was also on Twit this week, This Week in Tech 1008, talking about all sorts of stuff, the social media ban in Australia, all sorts of news. That was a good chat. Check it out.
Jeff Cannata.
Hey, you can buy Limerick at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. I make them for you with heart, with love, delivered via video. People dig it. You can read all the 5-star reviews there at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. A Limerick bespoke, written specifically for you or your loved one. It makes a great holiday gift. Why not? It makes a great pick-me-up for yourself. Check it out. cameo.com/Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with 2 N's and 1 T.
Always got to throw a shout out for our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can get ad-free episodes, early access episodes, exclusive After Dark episodes. We never want you to donate if it in any way causes you financial hardship. You can always support us for free by leaving a star rating for us on Apple Podcasts or becoming a supporter of us by sharing our videos on YouTube and on Instagram. Thanks to everyone who does something to help keep this podcast alive each week. All right, let's get to our review of Wicked.
Our paths did cross at school. Unlimited. Oh, you're green.
I am.
Together we're unlimited. She had her secrets.
Why is it you're always causing some sort of commotion?
I don't cause commotions. I am one. Some of us are just different.
Welcome to the Filmcast review of Wicked, New film by John M. Chu, available right now in theaters. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. Elphaba, a misunderstood young woman because of her green skin, and Glinda, a popular girl, become friends at Shiz University in the Land of Oz. After an encounter with the wonderful Wizard of Oz, their friendship reaches a crossroads, end quote. Jeff Cannata, I'm going to start with you today because I think you're the only person here who hasn't actually seen the musical Wicked. And you know the premise, but you don't really know the full true story of what is going on in this musical. So I'm just really curious, what did you think of Wicked?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I thought of Wicked is best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it, Jeff.
The visuals set it apart, and the leads are both great from the start. This movie explains more than courage or brains. What we want from our wizards is heart.
Oh, nice.
Movie wizards in this case. This, you're right. This is not usually my jam. I don't tend to enjoy musicals. There are exceptions to that, notable exceptions. But the style of songwriting in a musical is not usually what I'm there for, right? These aren't usually... sort of standalone hits, standalone boppers, right? The songs usually have a different, they're more
explanatory. They serve a function in the plot of the thing that you're watching, and they don't typically serve a function beyond that.
They rarely stand alone.
Right. I will say, though, right, for Wicked, this is a musical that is nonstop bangers.
I disagree with that.
Okay, all right, that's fair.
I think the music is great, and what I was leading up to is... this movie is sort of undeniably great, right? Mm. Even as somebody who's sort of not usually into this and somebody who, you know, you would think, hey, 2 hours and 45 minutes is something you're not usually into that doesn't even have an ending, might be a little much. And yet it's sort of undeniably magnificent, this movie. It's a visual splendor, right? It's just wonderfully inventive and cool. And I love the sort of Batman Beginsing of the Wicked Witch of the West, you know, sourcing all the things that we know from the Wizard of Oz. You know, she rides a bicycle. Oh, she rode a bicycle. You know, that kind of fun stuff that shows up that gives you, that plays on the things you already know. But really, what is special about this movie is that it really has a heart to it. There is a beauty to the message of this movie that resonated with me, and the lead performances are just fantastic. I can't say enough good things about the charm of this movie. It's a roller coaster ride in a lot of ways, but it's much more intimate than that, right? It's got all the big effects of a, you know, big popcorn movie. It's got all of the spectacle. It's got all of the wizardry you would expect from something of this scale. But I think ultimately captures something much smaller, much more intimate, much more resonant for me, and that is this relationship, this very relatable experience that we all have that can be funny and kind of over the top and goofy at times. But there is one scene in particular, the scene that happens at a dance, that I was just bawling in the theater at, and I think the ending is a crescendo. Even though, you know, the movie is a part one, it really ends on a crescendo.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Like, did you...
Banger of a type of a...
Did you feel ender. Like... I guess we can talk more in spoilers, but like, did you feel like this was a part one where you felt deprived of the part two? Or did you feel like, hey, that was a great movie, and if it ended there, that would be fine? You know, like, how did you feel?
Well, I think both are true in a lot of ways. I don't think the ending there would be fine necessarily, but it is... It definitely leaves dangling things unresolved, as you would expect. But I was impressed at the incredible feeling that you leave the theater with.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It really does. It is a crescendo. It is. I mean, if James Gunn can make a Superman as inspiring and sort of super heroic as
there are some Superman nods in this movie.
It's,
too.
Yeah. It's full Superman by the end of this movie.
Yes.
And
there's running
in the
jumping through
way.
A cornfield.
Yes.
At one point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. None of that was lost on me. I was like, man, James Gunn better up his game because this movie just out Superman. I do think the movie is long. It was particularly that experience was particularly accentuated for me because I was with my children. We took the whole family to see this on Thanksgiving morning. We went a 10:30 showing on Thanksgiving morning. We got up, we did a turkey trot where everybody runs in the freezing cold Colorado air.
What?
And then we went to the movie theater with my mother-in-law, my wife, my two kids. To see Wicked, my kids didn't know what to expect. I don't think either of them have seen Wizard of Oz.
Mm. Whose fault is that, Jeff?
Theirs.
Yeah, it's like they just never picked up the Apple TV and played Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, watch another episode of Bluey when Wizard of Oz is right there.
Mm.
No, but you know, my kids, you know, it's pulling teeth to have them watch anything live action. So my daughter, who is autistic and six, was pretty squirmy by the end, right? She got a little squirmy. I had to pick her up and put her in my lap. It was a long time to ask young kids to be in the theater. And I don't know if this movie is necessarily targeted at young kids, but I think it's great for young kids. And I think it could have benefited from trimming 20, 25, 30 minutes. I don't think the movie would have been worse off if we had lost some stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
It's rated PG. I was considering bringing my daughter to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, my son. I mean, my kids liked it. They both had a good time, and
that's awesome.
They
love that. Love that.
They both said they like Moana 2 more. So take that for what you will.
But I think it's clear, Jeff, that this movie is a much better film than Moana 2.
Yes, and my wife absolutely loved it. My mother-in-law absolutely loved it. I mean, this is a sort of a home run experience at the theater. And while I do think it's a lot to ask to carve out 3 hours of your life with trailers for this movie, it really delivers. And again, I want to reiterate what it delivers for me was that emotional through line that it is a powerfully packed emotional experience and one that I think is important and beautiful and of our time in a lot of ways, and just squeezes something out of a staid and tired old trope that I think feels refreshing and exciting and beautiful. So I really liked Wicked a lot.
Wonderful. Devendra, so curious what you thought of this movie.
Devendra did not want to watch this movie. Let's put that out there.
Devendra almost...
So many better options.
Devendra very gamely played along, but I'm like, first of all, the reviews have been excellent. It's a cultural phenomenon. I think we should talk about it. Devendra played along. Thank you, Devendra. What did you think of the actual movie?
So, I thought this movie defied the gravity of my expectations.
There was a lot...
Going against it like you, Jeff, like, a big musical. Not really my thing. I have seen the musical, so I'm like, I know this. I've heard the songs. I get it.
The witches sing, okay?
The witches sing. There's a backstory. Who's the real evil witch? You know, like, that's all. It was a really interesting concept. And, you know, the book and everything. Like, I remember, like, when the book initially came out and just the idea. I was like, huh, that's interesting that you can take, like, a really firm... like the way we think of a character and kind of change it a little bit and give more backstory and give more sympathy to the ostensible villain to story. So I always found that compelling. I saw the Broadway show, not with like Idina Menzel, not with like the big lead.
Yeah.
So it was fine. It was perfectly fine. I have no real attachment to the Oz stories or anything really, but I cannot deny the craft in this movie. Like John Chu does not phone it in.
Mm-hmm.
There's one complaint I'd say is like, it has a real digital sheen to it, which I think looks gross and is kind of unfortunate because there's a lot of great
Yeah, yeah, it's especially rough compared to the vivid Technicolor of the original Wizard of Oz.
There was clarity in the original movie.
It's very deliberate decision by John Chu. Like, he's seen Wizard of Oz. He knows what it is. He deliberately chose to shoot in a desaturated way. And the goal was to make it more quote-unquote realistic. Like, the Wizard of Oz is more dreamlike, whereas, you know, Wicked is more like, it's a world that you can see yourself in. Like, that's kind of the goal.
It's not a
decision that I would have made, but I'm not an award-winning filmmaker who's making, you know, $1 billion.
You know, so. And here's the thing. We know John Chu can make, like, big musicals and glorious color movies, too. Like, I'm thinking of, like, In the Heights and Crazy Rich Asians and everything, too. Like, he knows how to do this. It's like a very, like, almost, like, dreamlike style to this movie, too, I'd say. I don't know. The thing is, there are a lot of great practical elements in this film. I think the sets look fantastic. Yeah. There's a set that involves like moving clock thingies, the library that is just incredible. Like once I saw that,
costume design. It's going to win an Academy Award for costume design.
The way people look, the way creatures look, all pretty fantastic. I tend to go into a lot of movies, with like the action film mentality. It's like, be cool if there was a shootout or some sort of big fight scene here. And we go into that library. I'm like, oh, John Chu's gonna make a meal of this like rotating library with the wheels, and he did. He accomplished what I expected him to. So I cannot deny like the level of craft in terms of the filmmaking, the choreography, the dance work. Cynthia Erivo, an actress we all love, but I remember seeing her for the first time in Widows and being like, who is this? Who is this person who can like run down the street and make me feel like I am running along with her? Like I'm just fully on board with her. Then we saw her in Bad Times at the El Royale, movie we should all be talking about more.
So good.
She was the best part of The Outsider. I wish we got to see more of that character. So I am fully on board with everything Cynthia Erivo does. And she is incredible here. Like she is unstoppable, both because she makes us feel for Elphaba as a character. It's a little cartoonish how much everybody in this world hates her. A world where animals talk. You've got talking animals and a green lady is what you're.
Yeah, that's weird.
That's weird. That to me, that was a little much, but even that's kind of like worked into what this movie is really about. Ariana Grande is great. Like Ariana Grande for me exists as a name. It's like, that's a really cool name. Ariana Grande. No music, her like kid TV work, whatever. I'm not a part of that at all, but she's really impressive to me here as like a mean girl essentially. And she really relishes that role. Jeff Goldblum doing his thing, of course. But this movie does a good job of selling Elphaba as somebody who is just like always ostracized. And that makes her really relatable, you know, for many reasons. Like I find myself thinking of like, oh yeah, I don't know. Maybe it only happens in movies where you like walk into a party, and everybody goes quiet, or walk into a room and like that happens. That's happened to me. I'm like, don't feel too welcome here. This doesn't feel very. This is not like a fun place to walk into. So I kind of understand that feeling. There's a scene that I think you're referring to, Jeff, which takes place in complete silence, and is just purely Cynthia Erivo doing her thing, like really owning her character and trying to make a statement. Like I think is fantastic. I love so much of this movie. It is probably a little too long, but you know, I did not feel it. You know, I'm not the sort of person that will sit there and like hold I don't mind having to like run to the bathroom if I have to during a long movie, so I don't typically like feel the pressure there. The songs are all I'm not all the songs are a hit for me, but I think this is a great movie for the moment because what it's ultimately about, like it is the Oz story. And it's about an all powerful leader who's lying to citizens and is like, you know, finding a scapegoat for the problems going on in his kingdom. And like, oh, what a fun thing
literally
to educate kids on right now. And to prepare them for it. It's like baby's first little anti-fascist movie. That's literally what it is. So it's like, okay, kids, get your, you know, be ready.
Jeff,
be ready to fight.
Now,
I did. Yeah. It took me a second.
Yeah.
But
yes.
Literal scapegoat.
Yeah, literal scapegoat.
Literal scapegoat.
Devendra, I'm so pleased that you like this movie because Devendra was not excited about seeing it.
I mean, I didn't think I was going to hate it. I was not excited to see it. Yeah. That's all.
I'll say a few things. First of all, the entire Wicked musical, if you go see it on Broadway or wherever, is 2 hours and 45 minutes long. That includes a 15-minute intermission.
Yeah.
So
this is just the first act.
Yeah, this movie is 2 hours and 40 minutes long.
Well, there's a lot of the book
Right. Yeah. So people are asking, like, well, what's all the extra time? And it's like, it's more time spent developing people's relationships at Shiz University. That's what most of this movie is. And I think it's largely successful. I think this is possibly one of the best movie musicals ever. Perhaps the best movie musical ever. Mm. You know, there's like some
Singing in the Rain says what?
I was gonna say that's the thing. Is like you got to go back like 50 years plus to get something as good as Singing in the Rain. I agree. Okay, probably.
I mean, the original Wizard of Oz is pretty.
The original Wizard of Oz.
I agree. Okay, that's okay. How about the best movie musical of the last 50 years?
Liked West Side Story a lot.
Okay,
like I liked West Side
this
Story.
This is, in my opinion, this is
the new West Side Story. Yeah,
yeah. This is better than. Spielberg obviously super great, but like I think just in terms of the pure spectacle and enjoyment, I really loved Wicked. And the thing I'll just emphasize, I agree with everything you guys have said. First of all, I think audiences love seeing something real. And like, I know there's some amazing visual effects in this movie. I'm not downplaying that at all. But it is also clear that they got dozens of people together to like learn these elaborately choreographed dances. And they built these massive sets and did all this stuff to make it feel like, hey, it's people getting together on these big elaborate sets dressed in
this
elaborate costumes.
This is not AI bullshit. This is not CG.
And again, there is CG. There is visual effects. But like the core thing that you're watching is something real people did. And I think audiences respond to that in a way that is very powerful. And we're seeing that at the box office right now. And the other thing I'll just say, Ariana Grande, amazing comedic performance.
So good.
Cynthia Erivo is a generational talent. Like this is a...
Give her her Oscar now.
It is rare. Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel like made these roles originally.
So awesome to see them show up in this movie too.
Yeah. Those are difficult roles. Like it's not a super easy performance to deal to sing those songs. Like they're not necessarily the easiest songs to sing. And they kind of like made these characters famous. Like they immortalized these characters. And then for Cynthia Erivo to come in and potentially do a better job than Idina Menzel did, you know, performing some of these songs is incredible. Now it's subjective. It's up to you, but like she definitely at least gives her a run for her money, in my opinion.
And she also has to act more, you know? So it's like, she's juggling more for the character. Yeah.
She has to act more. I would say literally more because of the runtime, but it's also a very different performance because in a live stage performance, you're playing to the back of a room. Here, it's like a much more subtle performance. And it's just amazing to be able to see her do her thing. I will say one of the things I really liked about the movie is one thing I hate about a lot of movie musicals is, you know, they're talking, and then they start lip syncing to the song. And it's like, you can hear they're not actually singing it. In this movie, they did a good job of making it sound like they actually sang in the actual space that they're in. And I think they actually literally did in some instances. That also adds to the immersion of it. So many things to say about this movie that I enjoyed. I appreciated it. Didn't love the look of it like Devendra, right? Like
colors pop,
just,
man.
Just
you're so
the
close.
Color,
yeah.
The color saturation, you know, the color grading was not a fan of, but, everything else I was a fan of. And, I really enjoyed watching this movie. Go out, check it out in theaters right now.
I mean, this is a reason to get your butt to the theater. Like the experience of seeing this on an enormous screen with a great sound system. Yeah. Like that's it. This is why we go to the movies, you know?
Indeed.
Yeah, I was a bit bummed at my screening. The rear speakers were really miscalibrated. Oof. And I was wishing that I had. But hey, the reason for that is because most of the screenings were sold out.
Wow.
So we couldn't go into the Dolby Atmos theater because it was sold out. So I had to use the regular digital theater at my multiplex, and the sound was not as great. It's still, you know, still a great experience seeing it, but really worth seeing this with great sound. specifically these moments of crescendo that just like envelop you in the auditory experience.
Yeah.
Really worth it.
The final song is just like tremendous. Like that is where it kind of goes full Superman. Yeah. It's just beautiful.
I will tell you that I watched the movie and felt like the audio level was not in a good place. It didn't feel loud enough for what, like I couldn't, for instance, the first two songs I could barely understand.
John Chu was on, he was on social
John
media,
Chu has
right?
posted on X saying, tell your movie theater to turn it up to a 7. I've gone to a couple screenings and they are more like 6.4. If you want it the way it was intended, 7 is the way, end quote.
Mm-hmm. You know what I found when I march up to the 14-year-old kid at the ticket counter and I tell him what to do in the projection booth, it always works.
Absolutely.
It always works.
Absolutely. But I think his concern is warranted because my audio was not optimal, in my opinion. So anyway, those are some overall thoughts on Wicked. Let's talk about spoilers for the movie starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right. I think there are a lot of questions people have about how the second half of this movie is going to go.
Hmm.
I'm not going to spoil what happens in the second half, Jeff.
You mean part two of Wicked or part two
right,
of the second
sorry,
half of this actual second, film?
Part two of Wicked. You're right, Devendra. Yes. Part two of Wicked.
It is Wicked colon part two. I see online.
Yeah. So I think the issue is they want to end on defying gravity. Like,
yes.
You can't. It would be malpractice to market the movie, have the song Defying Gravity in it, and then not like in the trailer and then not have it in the movie.
I spent those 2.5 hours thinking, how are they gonna end on Defying Gravity? Like are you gonna make it a big moment? Or are you gonna
do something
else? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think they did a good job of making it a big, big moment.
The cut to the credits is just like a great, like you're saying, Jeff, like the crescendo. Just like end it there, leave the audience kind of blown away. And
she
then leaves
a
you
kind
wanting
of Neo
to come
Neo in Matrix Reloaded moment. Where she's
for sure. Yeah. Or I actually was thinking as I walked out of the theater, that old marketing line from Richard Donner, you will believe a witch can fly.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. I wanted to clap out loud when I saw the like nods to the Donner Superman, like the running through the cornfields. Like, yes, I see what you're doing here. And it's great. Love it. Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of questions because Defying Gravity is like, for those who don't know, it is the song of the musical. Like it's the one that the musical is most well known for. The second half of the musical, the songs are not as catchy. In my opinion, in general, there's no like showstopper like Defying Gravity. So I think it's a really interesting issue they have.
You're
like,
screwed now.
I don't think they're screwed, but it's like, you know, I think it's going to be a challenge to make the second one feel as momentous as the first one. You know what I mean?
Could they add new songs?
It's like, possible. Because, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows what they're going to do? They've already shot it. So like, I don't know what they're going to do. But also, we got to admire... I think it's Universal, right? For chopping this movie up because it's a big bet. It's a big bet that this movie is going to do well. And of course, the first one's a massive success. So if you make one that's a massive success, it's almost guaranteed the second one's going to be a huge
hit. I cannot imagine. Right? I feel like this movie is a sure bet as anything. I feel like Universal's like, we know Wicked is, this is what you want. You want to adapt a thing that everybody knows, that's already wildly popular, proven success. You shot extra footage? Okay, it's two movies now.
Well, somebody's in a room going, can we make it three?
Can we make it three? Yeah. I mean, same thing happened for Moana 2, right? It was like, we got this incredibly popular movie. Why is this on TV? Put this in a theater. That's what happened to Moana 2. So,
yeah. I mean, they did. There was an instance where remember when The Hobbit was only going to be two movies and they split it into three? You know, like similar. Yeah. Could have happened to this. Could have happened to Wicked as well. But yeah, I think the movie has a lot happening.
Yes.
There is this whole subplot about goats and animals
Animal
and how
rights,
they're being treated like second class citizens. And
Peter Dinklage is so good. Like he's not in the movie much, but he is very good at making you feel for
Peter Dinklage is good. I think it's like many people have interpreted it to be a metaphor about Jews. And so like that's going on while Elphaba is just trying to manage her life as a university student. And it's just there's a lot going on, and I'm actually glad that the movie has 5 to 6 hours to actually deal with that all, mm-hmm. because it's hard to really judge how effectively it's going to manage it all until we've seen the second half of the film. Overall, I'm really grateful this exists. Let's talk about the moment you guys are talking about. Like, it's fascinating because the moment you mentioned where they're at the Oz Dust Ball, I think is mm-hmm. what it is, where Glinda and Elphaba dance for the first time. In the musical, it's like quick. It's like super mm-hmm. fast moment. And it's still effective in the musical, but like in the movie, they really get to slow it down and focus on like Cynthia Erivo's facial expressions and her tears and all stuff you cannot experience in a musical. You cannot mm-hmm, see people's tears really in a musical. And that was kind of the best example of, wow, taking the cinematic format and augmenting what is in the musical. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Jeff, what you
yeah,
were really
I thought there was
moment,
an exquisite,
right?
an exquisite sequence, an exquisite moment. Devendra mentioned how the sound drops away and you're just left with this sort of movement. And there's the beauty of these two people connecting, and the sort of generosity of that, the courage from, Elphaba and the, you know, and the sort of reciprocity and generosity from Glinda. It's a beautiful, beautiful, that's cinema, right?
It just
that's,
comes out of nowhere too. Like it just hits you like a truck in the yeah. middle of the movie.
Dude, I gotta say, you know, I mentioned it briefly, but the costumes are so great.
Yeah.
And the silhouette that you get of the Wicked Witch and the hat alone, like we've all seen a witch's hat millions of times, right? It's a staple for Halloween. The way there's like life and character in that witch's hat is so great. And mm-hmm. you see her enter that scene and you just see the silhouette and that she wore the hat and you just, and everybody starts snickering at her and the way that is all built up and you're just sort of inside that emotional moment. Yes, the time that Chu takes to allow that all to settle on the audience. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, guys, this week I watched a prequel where a villain who fights for an oppressed species has a sympathetic backstory, shows how they met and split from their best friend, and also shows how they learned to levitate a coin and fly, and also where they got their iconic hat. But enough about X-Men First Class. Let's get back to our conversation about Wicked.
Wait, who has an iconic hat?
Magneto, dude. Come on.
Magneto's helmet. It's
iconic
helmet.
Hat.
Yes.
Everybody knows.
That is a letterbox list from Jammy Who 21, FY. So
there's so many things we could have done. We could have done Gladiator 2. You know, I saw a movie about an outcast trying to defeat a corrupt emperor. Yeah.
Yeah.
anyway, I mean, we could have done Harry Potter for that matter.
Could have done it all.
Wow. Wow. All right. Any other thoughts?
I mean,
Wicked?
Good movie. Good movie.
Yeah, good movie. It was nice, as we mentioned, Christian Chenoweth and Idina Menzel.
It was
Shaw,
awesome
like,
seeing
to
them
kind of
pop
like
up.
Hand their roles off in a way to the. Yeah.
They get a moment to shine, which is lovely, and you really see them together. I love Christian Chenoweth. I just ever since Pushing Daisies, like
seriously,
You know, I absolutely adore her, and you know, they both. There's a moment where. That really brief moment where they push back the new stars and you know it's like very I loved it. I love the like levels that is playing.
Yeah,
on.
Definitely.
I love how so the opening scene is Glinda telling the story of how Elphaba came to be and was born. I kind of love how the movie's not even trying to hide. Like it's like no. It's Jeff Goldblum singing to her mother. Yeah. You know, like green is a very key point of that whole thing. And then at the end, he's like, "I would love to treat you like a child, like a daughter."
yeah. It was Jeff Goldblum's voice was identifiable. Okay, Jeff Cannata, I am curious, right? Like, you presumably don't know where the story ends, correct?
Correct.
Like you don't know like how it ties into Wizard of Oz exactly.
Right.
I think you probably get the sense that what we saw in Wizard of Oz is not exactly as we believed it. Right?
Yes, that's right.
That there might be some, like, if this is canonical, yeah, which it's not, this is not canonical, but like.
There are some readings that people say, like, the Wizard of Oz, as we saw it, the film, is sort of like the propaganda of the story, right? And this is like, right, what is actually happening behind
it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess I'm curious, like, so far, you know, has how you look at Wizard of Oz changed in any way? Or is there anything you're like wondering about for part two? You know, just curious, like, if there's anything you're like, oh, I wonder how this all fits in.
Well,
you know?
Certainly. I mean, I think the way this movie opens is the big question mark, right? Is because everybody's celebrating the Wicked Witch is dead. Glinda at this point is celebrating too. And, you know, we literally burn her in effigy. Right. And so to get to a point where she is so reviled and that celebration happens and rectifying that relationship and the sympathies that you would assume that Glinda the Good Witch would have, you know, like the moment in Wizard of Oz is, are you a good witch? Or are you a bad witch? You know, it's right, like asking Dorothy that, right? And it's like, well, is she assuming Dorothy went to Shiz University and studied?
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of incongruities that I assume will be hammered out. But I'm not like, you know, I'm not worried in any sense.
Right? It's kind of funny. We see Dorothy. We see the friends early on in the movie, like a CG reinterpretation.
Yeah, that was
going
cool.
Down the yellow brick road, which also made me think, how are they going to screw this up? They're going to look at the success of this movie. They're going to look at the likely success of the next movie and be like, you know what we haven't remade in a while? The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, isn't there, I was reading somewhere, somebody saying that they should do the, isn't there a book that is the origin story of the wizard?
There are many books.
There's already a movie called Oz the Great and Powerful, directed by Sam Raimi.
Have we forgotten about Oz the Great and Powerful?
A movie that has no cultural footprint. Fewer people talk about this movie. Fewer people talk about this movie than talk about Avatar. Like, no one remembers this movie. I'm pretty
never
sure
happened.
We reviewed it on this podcast.
We reviewed it. We absolutely reviewed it.
I literally couldn't tell you a single thing that happens in that film.
James Franco is Oz.
Yes.
Zach Braff is a monkey. Yeah.
I do love the fact that Goldblum is in this point in his career where he just plays people like Zeus, the Wizard of Oz. Like he's reached this level of like, he can't play a mortal human being, like a normal.
Yeah.
He's achieved a status where like the only parts that make sense for him.
Yeah.
Are gods. Yeah. You know,
like, we really got to get him and like Nick Cage in the thing and just have them do their shtick at each other for two hours.
Absolutely.
That's a Face-Off remake.
Yeah, well, basically.
I'm just going to say this, Jeff. I am looking forward to seeing your reaction to Wicked Part 2 because I think you'll find some of the ways it ties into The Wizard of Oz to be surprising and delightful.
That's great. I don't recall it being particularly mind-blowing, but...
And we'll recontextualize perhaps how you see the movie. The one downside of Wicked... Mm-hmm. Like Wicked develops these really interesting backstories for all these characters. The one downside is if you believe Wicked is true, quote unquote, it does remove the interpretation that the Wizard of Oz was like all in Dorothy's head. You know what I'm saying? Like that's one of the
things. I never liked that. It was always kind of silly.
Did she dream the whole thing?
It's implicit,
like,
the whole thing. Yeah. You were there and you were there and you were there. I mean, that's sort of implicit in the ending of the movie.
Mm-hmm. That it was all in her head, you're saying, right?
Yes, that's a plausible reading.
Yes,
absolutely.
And I'm saying, like you know, that doesn't really work.
What if she constructed a whole universe while she was reading? Yeah. A whole narrative in her mind.
Yeah, she had a whole backstory. Oh, you're right. Actually, that's true, David. You're right.
Yes. It could. What if she was just in a coma for a year? She had time. Like J.R., like George Martin, to like.
A hell of a hurricane.
Yes.
Man.
Absolutely. All right.
Tornado, I should
say. At the end of the day, it is really impressive that John Chu made a movie. And that's our thoughts on Wicked, and that's the episode for today. Stay tuned to what we'll be discussing next week. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes courtesy of Tim McEwen from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode. Video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast... This was going to be a movie we were going to review on the main review a few weeks ago. And then Warner completely. I don't even know how to describe what they did to this movie. They
slapped Clint Eastwood in the face.
It made their day, if you know what I mean.
They neutered this movie. You know, like they basically. Yeah.
They did not feel lucky, punks.
They hung them high with a fistful of dollars.
No?
Yeah, I mean, what?
They thought it was not good, probably bad, and a little ugly.
I'm going to say Warner remains unforgiven for what they did to this movie.
They didn't want to sully their reputation, guys. So.
I'm going to say I want to run over the person who made this decision with a Gran Torino.
You're making me cry macho over here. Yeah.
They did
this movie dirty, Harry.
They didn't realize they had $1 million baby on their hands. They did such a bad job that one wanted to hire an American sniper to take out
put this movie right in the line of fire.
It's a true crime what happened to this movie. Yeah.
Invictus. Okay, anyway.
They wanted to put this guy in a car with a monkey. I can't remember what that movie was called.
Yeah, the monkey thing.
What was the monkey movie that he did? I can't remember the name of it.
They didn't realize this movie could be the Richard Jewell of their crown. They were not space cowboys in how adventurous they were in marketing this. Okay. The movie's Juror Number 2. It's available right now on video on demand. It will be available on Max, the one to watch for HBO, in a few weeks. We wanted to review it, but the theatrical release was very muted for this film. But there's a lot to discuss. It's a movie made by one of the great living filmmakers of all time. We are looking forward to discussing it here on the Filmcast next week as we wrap up 2024.
Any which way you can.
Okay.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
See you later. You know, the way they handled this movie release was a heartbreak ridge,
so close,
as it were.
So close.
Jeff, you're muted.
You guys may have wicked screeners, by the way. I just got one this morning.
Every which way but loose.
The people who handled this movie need blood work done.
Every which way but loose.
It had
even screwed that up.
This movie had a sudden impact on me.
That was well done. Well done.
I was so sad they had to play Misty for me.
They really threw down the gauntlet on how to badly manage a movie. The people who handled the theatrical release should be escaping from Alcatraz because they should be in jail.
They didn't want to release this movie. They were busy painting their wagon.
This movie goes where eagles dare.
They could have released this movie and gotten a few dollars more.
All right, I'm stopping now.